actually after resuscitation can be good, neutral, and it can be bad. And sometimes in really difficult situations, you know, leaders are born, people gain confidence in their own abilities, and you get real positives out of a negative. And post-traumatic growth kind of describes that phenomenon where people kind of come out the other side actually better people and better for having been involved in something really horrible.
Hello and welcome to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Fionn Davis, your host for today. I'm an emergency medicine doctor and expedition doctor. And in this session, we're speaking with Matt Walton, a fellow emergency medicine doctor working as an A&E registrar up in the north of England. Delighted to have you on the podcast, Matt. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Fionn. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. And I'm very excited to talk about what we're going to talk about.
Absolutely. So I first heard about Matt's involvement with the Resus Council Resuscitation and Wellbeing Guidance and Resource when we were working together on one of the WEM courses up in North Wales. And we realised that we had a bit of a mutual interest in this, and I've kept an eye out for when this was getting published because he was eagerly working on it in every spare moment he had when we were on the course. And the guidance has recently been published earlier this year. So that's the Resus Council Resource on Resuscitation and Wellbeing for Responders. I'm sure you're going to put it much better than I have, Matt, but do you want to give us a little bit of an overview about this and then maybe a bit of what got you into it?
Yeah, of course. So this is the Resus Council Wellbeing Resource for Responders, and it's a resource that's the first of its kind that essentially tries to answer that question of what can we do in order to protect, preserve, and help the well-being of responders who, let's face it, go to lots of nasty stuff every day and sometimes get affected by what they do. And it's an amazing thing to have been involved in and have got to work on, because we've managed to get experts from all across the world who are really the top in their field to contribute to this resource. And hopefully it represents the first iteration and the best effort of information that we can give to people to kind of get some consensus on those topics that we've previously found a little bit muddy, like debriefing, for example, and hopefully give us some direction and guidance as to what we can do in the aftermath of some of these difficult events.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those topics that many of us have developed our own sort of way of dealing with things, or our way of conducting debriefs or looking after well-being or promoting well-being in our teams. But there's never really been a kind of evidence-based guidance out there. So this is long awaited and much needed, and hopefully is going to provide some overarching principles on how we should be doing those things in order to look after our people, our teams, and ourselves a little bit better. So how did you first get involved with this, Matt? How did your interest start?
So interest started probably about 5 or 6 years ago when I was a medical student, and I got an opportunity to basically follow a pre-hospital care team in an air ambulance and get to see some real cutting-edge medicine, which was, I think, Fionn, you're also interested in this, probably the most exciting thing you can do as a student is to go and ride in a helicopter and watch some really cool people do some really cool stuff and ultimately save lives. So for me, it was like a dream come true. And I remember meeting a doctor called Mike Christian and a paramedic called Tony, who were both super inspirational. And I got to watch them really perform amazing miracles for people. But on the flip side to that, I learned the hard way that the closer you are to saving lives, the closer you are to witnessing death and seeing some really nasty things. And I remember I got to see my first cardiac arrest. I got to see, you know, hangings. And ultimately, we had one case that was particularly difficult. That was a traumatic cardiac arrest in a child. And it was the first one that I'd ever seen like that. And I remember in the aftermath of that, I kind of experienced flashbacks and intrusive thoughts. And you know, I'd be in a supermarket and little reminders would trigger these really quite visceral reactions in me. And I remember thinking that that could have been something that was really isolating and really frightening and really scary, because ultimately at medical school and back then, there was very little information and very little education on that sort of thing. But having had a chance to sort of debrief the case and think about what we could have learned and done better, I also had the opportunity to ask the doctor, you know, what do I do now and what could happen to my brain basically after this event? And they delivered some really simple but profound education. And it was basically, you know, you got a sense that it was built on a lifetime of experience in this field. And it was, you know, yeah, we all get affected by this. It can affect your brain. It can make you feel really sad at times. You can also get flashbacks and symptoms similar to what we get in PTSD. But it's really common. And if you do get this, talk about it with us. It'll, in all likelihood, get better over time. And he also gave me the opportunity to talk. He said, well, you know, why don't you give me a text and I'll text you in a little bit, like in a few weeks' time, and we'll just see how we're doing and kind of catch up with each other. And that, just as simple as it sounds, completely blew my mind, because it was the first person that I'd ever really acknowledged that this was a thing. And so from there, we talked with a paramedic and we realized that actually the paramedic had had a really similar sort of experience, and realized that, you know, these experiences are really common, but we're all kind of not talking about them as much as we could. And so we kind of made it our aim to educate as many people as possible and kind of share that simple education, and also get to the bottom of the problem, understand about it, and figure out how we could fix it. And so we set about making a film together, essentially to capture our story and to sort of deliver some of those learning messages. And at the time, that was considered a really big risk, because it was essentially taking an air ambulance team who is funded by public donations and saying, well, you know, this team's just got really mentally hurt by what they've done, and the public have funded this, and it, is there a chance that the public might decide not to continue donating, like, because this stuff wasn't really well known? And in fact, you know, the public have a really good understanding of the military. You know, people go to war, they get PTSD, and that's a sort of common phenomenon we understand quite well. But we don't really understand people going to work in as a paramedic on the roadside on Christmas Day, and then coming back and not being able to enjoy Christmas dinner with their family, and having a terrible night's sleep and being profoundly affected by what they've seen. And the, I'll have to get the name right, King's College Military Health Research Group, they did a lot of research on military veterans, essentially estimating the prevalence of PTSD symptoms. And after the Iraq and Afghanistan involvement of the British Army, they estimated it around about 6%. And there's recent studies showing that in acute care services, it's actually about 10% that are using the same kind of tests and studies. So actually, what we needed to understand as a public is that PTSD, the idea of a paramedic going to work and then coming home and being really traumatized by what they've seen, is actually almost more frequent and more common than what we see with soldiers. So we embarked on this massive quest of trying to get this information out there. We managed to make a BBC documentary, essentially, revealing a statistic on the Office of National Statistics website, which had sort of been overlooked, saying, yeah, the paramedic suicide rate is double that of the general population. And through that, we got loads of positive feedback, we got loads of interaction with loads of different specialists, and then we managed to meet this enormous group of experts from around the world who'd all spent their lives working on this topic, and kind of be able to pick their brain to understand some of the nuances, some of the topics involved in it. So I'm aware that I don't want to talk your ear off, Fionn, and go on for too long on this topic. I'm sort of wondering, from your perspective, like, how much you think this field's changed kind of over the last 5 or 6 years since then, because all of this, what kind of got me interested, was quite a long time ago. And since then, I guess things have changed a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose I don't remember getting any formal training on how to react or what would be expected after a difficult resuscitation, especially in medical school. I don't really think that was touched on upon much. And I think my big revelation was when I was a sort of F2, F3 working in ED, and kind of thinking that we were just supposed to absorb this, that this was just part of the job, that it was part of the process of toughening up and just being able to cope with it and deal with it. And it's kind of that realization that you had, that actually once you start talking to people about this, generally everybody is having the same sort of feelings about it, but not really talking about it. I suppose since then, since I sort of had that realization that if I'm feeling like this, probably other members of the team are feeling like this also. I've tried to incorporate debriefs in some form or other, like a hot debrief or a cold debrief. I think we're going to go into that a little bit more. And I'm sort of thinking about how to best protect myself and how to look after a team as well, as I've sort of progressed a bit through my career. But I've kind of been winging it for the most part, watching what other people do and then trying to figure out what works for me. But I've not really had any formal training in it, and I think this is probably the kind of first step towards incorporating that. And I think that's reflected by the Rhesus Council courses as well, starting to incorporate a little bit of sort of debrief and well-being within ALS and resuscitation as well.
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, hit the nail on the head. Like, we've all sort of been winging it, and we're desperate for expert advice and expert input. And I think if to sort of name a few people who've been quite pivotal in the resource and sort of what they brought to our understanding, not just for this resource, but sort of in mental health as a whole. So one thing is, well, we kind of made this assumption that it's, you know, it's PTSD. So it's like, it's as I'd simplified it there, like, you know, you've got someone who goes to see something nasty and gets PTSD. But is that the whole story? Is PTSD the only thing we need to worry about, first of all? So we've got moral injury. So I'm not sure if that's something that you've heard of, Fia.
That actually came onto my radar in COVID. Which I think is probably the same for most people, that this concept of not being able to provide what we feel we should be able to, and is compromising to our moral values. So in COVID, that, you know, that sort of manifested as not being able to get everybody a ventilator who needed one.
Yes.
That was a sign of, exactly, kind of common thing that started happening. We're like, right, well, this person needs to go to ITU. There's no ITU beds. Right, well, what do we do now? And it probably led to little slips in our maybe judgment as to we probably had to get a little bit harder in terms of you had to be really, really fit and really, really in need of a ventilator in order to get one during COVID. And that, but we know that that's not best practice or not what we would want to do. And so it's sort of highly damaging to how we see ourselves as a doctor. Are we no longer a good doctor? Are we making bad decisions because we work in a broken system? That was kind of how moral injury first came across my radar anyway, and it's inherently linked to many health. Like, I think healthcare in general, paramedics, doctors, whatever, like, our identity is part of our profession. So if we somehow feel compromised in that we're not a good doctor or we're not a good paramedic because we can't deliver the care to our patients that we want to because we're stuck on the back of an ambulance for 20 hours, for example, somehow that's compromised who we are, which is, I think, even harder to deal with.
Exactly. And no, it's beautifully put. And that, so Esther Murray essentially is the psychologist and doctor who's pioneered this sort of use of moral injury to describe how we're feeling sometimes in medicine. And she looked at a lot of research in Vietnam War veterans who, exactly as you're describing, it's essentially like a shame of what's happened and feeling like, you know, you're not good or it's not so much like the visual aspect of trauma. It's more the, like, something isn't right here, or I've done something wrong, or I've been a part of, or I've witnessed something that I don't agree with, like this, and I don't think this is right. And they were finding that a lot of the veterans who were suicidal, they weren't able to kind of put the finger on it with PTSD, and there was something deeper, and it was this kind of idea of taboo and stuff that we don't really, we're ashamed of even talking about, is a big factor in how moral injury really affects us. And I think we probably find that in our own practice. You know, sometimes we might even find it easier now that we've got a good awareness and a good openness to talk about traumatic things that we see. I think possibly one of the next things to sort of break the taboo on is things where we think we've messed up, or we've made a mistake, or we've done things that aren't right, or that we don't feel happy about in our soul. And so Esther Murray kind of really brought that into medicine, and sort of she's released a book recently called Borrowed Words, which essentially summarizes that idea of it's creating words that we can use to describe how we're feeling in those situations, which is really helpful. So that was one thing alongside PTSD. And then you've got anxiety, you've got depression, you've got compassion fatigue, you've got burnout. There's lots of ways to describe the negative effects that this can have on us. One person as well, Dr. Kevin Teo, I've been really inspired by, because they essentially said, right, we're trying to conceptualize responder well-being as this, you know, you see this, it's like cause and effect, and you've got this thing happens, and then you feel really bad afterwards. But actually, what if we take a step back in our understanding of responder well-being, and we think, well, that's one thing, but what about everything else that makes us feel upset or bad at work? And he essentially said, well, what about the organization and the environment that we're working in? And as soon as you say it, it makes total sense. It's like, well, what about the fact that we're working night shifts and we're not getting any sleep, all of these system things? What about the resources that we have available? You know, we both work in NHS A&Es in 2023 in a sort of legitimate national crisis. What about civility and people being nice to you at work and all those things? Like, what about your pay, your benefits, your resources, your sense of value, autonomy? All of these other things really come into it. So, as well as that, you know, working through crisis as well, you've got Professor Richard Williams, who's done loads of stuff on that with someone called Verity Kemp. And you've got Professor Neil Greenberg, who's been a huge part in our understanding of going back to that root of PTSD and what should we be doing with debriefing. And essentially what I'm trying to say is we've been lucky to have so many experts who completely shaped our understanding and really devoted their lives to trying to get the best understanding for us, the responders and the people on the ground, so we can kind of devise some sort of roadmap for what's the best way to help us. And I guess that's where this new resource comes into it. It's built on years of experience from everyone, and hopefully for the first time it creates some consensus with the best organization to do that with, which is the Recess Council, who are sort of the masters of creating expert world-leading consensus on what's the best thing to do in this situation, and putting it together. And there we have, after quite a few years, the Resuscitation Council Wellbeing Resource, a short history tour.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to understand the background and how much work and how much expert advice and input has gone into this guidance, because when you do look through the resource, there is some really valuable things in there. And I think, should we go through some of the main sort of points of the resource and then talk through exactly how that can be applied in practice, I guess. So let's think about... I'll let you wrote it. You can, rather than me question your niche individual section.
So essentially the structure of the resource, if I'll give a brief summary of it, and then we can kind of go in bit by bit, and then we can talk about, you know, I'm sure as we've had a bit of pre-discussion and we've got a lot of cases that we can bring in, and I think this is going to be a full-on therapy session for me and Theon as we talk about all of the things that have happened to us in our practice. So the structure or the premise is essentially, you know, as a resuscitation provider, most of the cases that you go to by definition will be unsuccessful. The person will die despite your active efforts to save their life, as we know with the statistics of resuscitation, out of hospital cardiac arrest, in hospital cardiac arrest, it's more likely that they are going to be dead at the end of the day than alive. And that's the reality. And it's essentially, it's a duty of ours to provide help and guidance and information for people to try and alleviate the potential suffering of that process on responders. So the structure is, how will your well-being be affected by being involved in resuscitation, or as we've termed it, an exposure to resuscitation? What is the recommended post-resuscitation procedure? What should we all be doing after exposure to resuscitation? Where's the evidence, and what currently do we have evidence for doing? And then the third bit is having that perspective and taking that step backwards to say, well, resuscitation exposure and the immediate effects are one thing, but responder well-being isn't just a binary, are you going to resuscitation or not, and are you affected by resuscitation or not? It's actually this really nuanced, multifaceted thing of, you're working in an environment, and actually your environment has arguably more of an effect on your well-being than whether you're exposed to a resuscitation that is traumatic for you or not. And then we split that into organizational factors, leadership factors, sort of into colleague and interpersonal factors, and then individual tips on what we can all do for ourselves, and basically how you can help at every single level in your organization, and all the way down to just personally you, as to how you can try and preserve and protect your well-being while you're doing what's often a very gnarly and very stressful job. So, let me ask you, Fionn. You have told me that certainly you've been involved in a lot of cases, and you're incredibly experienced at this point. How do you find your well-being is affected by exposure to resuscitation?
You can see I'm smiling wryly because I still feel that I'm very very inexperienced, and there's definitely a lot of highly experienced people out there who may have worked with me, who may be thinking, ha, Fionn, that little baby genie doctor we used to work with. But anyway, I have been fortunate or unfortunate enough to have had some seminal cases that certainly stick out in my mind as being difficult. So I think when I first started working in A&E as a clinical fellow in F3, so there was one resuscitation, I guess, which was of a teenager overnight who had come off a motorbike. He'd been shunted from behind on a motorway, fairly high speed, and had sustained some very nasty Max Fax injuries, massive head injury, and was essentially scooped up by the paramedics. It was an off-duty paramedic who actually found this poor lad. Already had, I think at scene they said the resps were sort of 7 gurgly, and they'd put in an OP, and they were 5 minutes from the hospital because it was literally just one exit down the motorway, so they just brought them as quick as they could. And it was one of those kind of moments where you take a handover and you say, are there any immediate concerns? And the paramedics were like, airway. I was like, oh right. Okay, so right, this is it, guys. Like, this is the real deal. And my registrar at the time was also working with Wales Air Ambulance, and was a very, very good doctor that I admired a lot. And actually, I was so pleased that it was him that was on nights with me that time. And he did an excellent job of leading the resuscitation team. I mentioned that he had a lot of Max Fax injuries. We didn't actually know how old he was until we sort of found out a bit later. He was actually 17. He was on his way home from work, and he had very unstable facial fractures. He had bleeding into his airway. He was very difficult to intubate. He then had a pneumothorax. He had swallowed a tooth. He had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. He had lots of multi-organ injuries, ended up being transferred to the major trauma center, where he unfortunately died. So my main learnings from this was that feeling of like, right, this is it, this is what we train for, this is the moment that all that training is going to come into practice, and how the team actually felt afterwards was fairly positive, in that we felt we'd done a good job. We felt we'd resuscitated him well. We'd had really good leadership from the registrar, and we felt we'd done all we could And there was a clear sort of debrief afterwards on this is what happened, ABC, we did this, this is why. This was hard. Some people are going to feel affected by this. And then I think he said something like, you know, like, come and talk to me if you need to, sort of thing. So for me, that was, right, I want to be this guy. This guy, he has made all the difference to how this team feels about this resuscitation, the way he's ran it, the way, you know, so that was my main takeaway and probably a bit of a major inspiration for me. Was I was completely flapping, very junior, didn't know what to do. And yeah, felt very helpless and lost at that point. And I'm so glad that he was there to help sort of guide me through it. And now I want to be that person, if I can, that A, smashes a trauma resus, and B, really helped guide my juniors as well through it.
Yeah, definitely. And well, thanks so much for sharing that, because that definitely doesn't sound like an easy case to be involved in. In fact, it sounds like probably one of the worst cases imaginable to be faced with. But it sounds amazing that you've got that positive outcome from it, and obviously the outcome for the patient was terrible, and I'm sure it will have been devastating for everyone involved in it. However, despite that, you've kind of taken away from that you want to improve and you want to learn and be better. And I'm sure, you know, you're going to save loads of lives moving forwards from the inspiration and the drive that you've got, if not many lives already, Fiona. And that's I suppose something called post-traumatic growth. So, and it's an important thing to mention that, you know, the assumption is that you'll go to resuscitations and something, you'll feel terrible afterwards and it'll affect you profoundly in a negative way for the rest of your life. But actually, after resuscitation can be good, neutral, and it can be bad. And sometimes in really difficult situations, you know, leaders are born, people gain confidence in their own abilities, and you get real positives out of a negative. And post-traumatic growth kind of describes that phenomenon where people kind of come out the other side actually better people and better for having been involved in something really horrible. So I guess the nutshell and the learning from that, which is really helpful from that case, is that it's not all bad. But a lot of the time, sometimes it is very bad, and sometimes it does really affect us, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think as well that I'm just remembering, I don't think I really had any good expectation on how I was going to feel afterwards, but I don't remember being told, that this is going to be upsetting, that you might have some sort of flashbacks or intrusive thoughts sort of things about this, and that's normal. I don't sort of remember being told that, but I did have that where I had these sort of moments where I'd see his face, or where I could remember sort of trying to jaw thrust him and everything moved under my fingers. I just couldn't, and just all horribly unstable. And I'd get those thoughts just sort of just popping into my brain, whether it was doing something else at work to do with a face, you know, if I was like examining somebody's jaw or something, and then that would sort of, that image would come into my head, or yeah, thinking about how it felt, and that would sort of come back to me for several months afterwards. So I wasn't really sure if that was normal or not at the time. And I remember speaking to some of the other people involved, and it was one of those cases that gets talked about in the department for quite a while afterwards, because everybody was sort of like, oh my God, did you hear about that? Yeah. And other people were finding that too.
Yeah, so, well, what you're describing certainly is absolutely common, and I'm relating completely to that in the case that I described at the start, and I still find it amazing in some ways how common all these experiences are and how, you know, often people experience it. But as you say, you don't know whether that's normal or not, because historically it's not really been talked about, and we're not 100% sure what is normal and what's not. So I guess that goes on to the next part of the resource quite nicely is, yeah, what is normal to feel afterwards. So in effect, a lot of the numbers and the cutoffs we put on things are going to be arbitrary. That there's, you know, we say roughly, you know, if symptoms persist after about a month, then it's worth seeking support. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's abnormal or not normal. It's just a point at which it would be worth letting someone else know that you're still experiencing these symptoms, because after that point, I suppose you could fairly say it's had a significant effect on you if you're experiencing them that much and persistently. For me, I experienced that, and again, the child that particularly disturbed me had also had horrific facial injuries. And I think there's something especially about the face that just comes back to haunt you in a way like no other bodily injury will. So you know, it's normal to think about these things afterwards, definitely. And I guess the question is, you know, when do we start to flag up that as a concern? And I think at any point after a month, we'd recommend that you talk to someone about that. Well, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, your official supervisor or your GP, just talking to friends and family members and other colleagues, just so they're kind of aware of what you're going through. And ideally, the gold standard would be letting someone, ideally someone designated at your hospital, kind of know that, you know, that that's still something that's ongoing, so they can embark on this process called active monitoring, which is essentially where we're just like, yep, we're aware that's happening, and we're going to decide what to do, either whether that's escalating it if you're really, really struggling and it's interfering with your day-to-day life and we think we need to do something more, or actually saying, you know what, like, yeah, you're experiencing these. If you're okay with it and you're still managing and you're kind of happy not to be intervened in at the moment, then we're happy with that too. And we'll kind of just monitor you and just keep an eye on you and just check that these symptoms slowly start to resolve and get back to normal over time. So that's essentially kind of where we're at with what's normal, what's not normal. It's a bit of a question mark. Everyone's going to have very different reactions. We can turn them as the initial reaction as an acute stress reaction, where you have a constellation of behavioral, psychological, somatic symptoms like lack of sleep, nausea, the actual flashbacks and visceral reactions to it, and that's kind of commonly can last for like in that first month, and then any persistence after that is kind of, we'd like to capture that in a safety net to make sure that people aren't struggling. But the bottom line is, if at any point after the event you have severe symptoms that are really getting in the way of your daily life and you're finding it really difficult and you're getting in the way of your work, or just simply that you're worried or you're not sure what's going on, then just seek help. Ask someone, talk to someone. There's no point putting a time limit on it. If it's affecting you, it's affecting you now, and there's ways that help can be solved.
I've heard stories about people sort of years after an event don't realize it, but then years after, you know, sort of developing more serious signs of PTSD, and then not necessarily even relating it to the initial kind of stressor to start with, but there is no definite timeline, is there, but the recommendation is, like you said, like a month or so, and then worth trying to seek some help just to make sure, just to check in, really, isn't it? It's not necessarily to say, I think a big reason people don't seek help is that it's somehow admitting failure or admitting that you can't cope, or that, which is I'm sure you're going to go on to some of the stigma about it. But that's not true. It's about just saying, look, like that was pretty rough. That was quite hard. I'm still struggling with it. Think I'm okay, and I'm getting through it, or don't really think I'm okay. Think I might need a bit of help with this.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't have put it better myself. I think, yeah. And it's also like with the stigma, I think, because it's often hard, like we feel a bit, even me, who's literally helped to write this resource on wellbeing, you feel sometimes a bit powerless to help and a bit powerless as to what to actually say to someone. So when you're speaking, there's an element of I'm thinking in my head, well, I don't really know what I can possibly say that's going to make you feel better. But actually, sometimes listening is helpful. And also you saying about how you feel is massively helpful for me, because and I've seen you talk about some of the cases you've been involved in before, and that gives me reassurance that, oh, like, Fionn's this like really epic doctor who does all this really cool stuff, and actually, like, she's kind of dealing with that as well, and that makes me think, oh well, if I aspire to kind of do what you do in a couple of years time, then that's okay if I still feel like that. Like, I shouldn't have this expectation like you described, where it's kind of, oh well, your whole point of your medical career is to just toughen yourself up so you're never affected by these things, which ultimately just isn't yeah. true at all, because I think we're all affected all the time.
I think it's a bit of a journey too, because as a junior you feel that you can't show weakness because you'll be seen to fail training, or you're not good enough, or you're not cut out to be a doctor. And then as you get like slightly more senior, you feel you can't talk about it or show weakness because your juniors are looking to you to be the strong one, or to be the one that's okay with it all and that's gonna, you know, magically make everyone feel better. And then I'm sure, even as a consultant, you know, I'm not there yet, but I'm sure you still have those feelings of not feeling able to sort of show that vulnerability. But on the flip side of that, I think even from juniors all the way up to seniors in terms of like doctor structure anyway, but also in pre-hospital and other healthcare professions, if your junior says they're struggling, it then suddenly opens up the floor to everybody else to be able to say, oh yeah, like actually that was quite hard. And if you've got a good senior to support you, they should be understanding. They should want to understand how you're feeling, rather than being like, oh well, that's tough for you. let's just crack on with the rest of the shifts. No, and you might even find that by saying something yourself, you allow that possibly more senior person to say, yeah, that was a hard one. And if you hear that from them, it kind of just validates how you feel as well.
And I think that probably brings us on to debriefing and you know, what we should and shouldn't be doing on that topic, because I suppose that's that, when, you know, especially as we're sort of branching into leadership positions now in our work and people look to you after those events to say something or know what to do. And so far, as you put it nicely earlier, we've kind of been winging it. So essentially, what we'd recommend now is, and what we've tried to term and structure based on the evidence we have available to us at this point in time, is a post-resuscitation procedure, basically what you do after exposure to resuscitation. And that consists of an operational debrief, arranging active monitoring, and periodic team reflection. And these are the things that currently we've got some evidence for being worthwhile to do. And that's, as well as those things, it's plus or minus referring, which basically means, as we kind of touched on before, if we're worried that someone's badly affected and they might need some more help, then just signposting and making sure that they get to the resources that they need, whether that's the GP or in-house occupational health service, talking to the mentor and being monitored. So the debrief. Now, it's important to understand a bit of the history about how we've debriefed in the past in order to understand where we're at now. So coming at it from a well-being perspective, there was a concept which was sort of 10 years or so ago called critical incident stress debriefing, which is basically after an event, we should get everyone down and we should go in detail about the traumatic nature of the event and, you know, talk about what was difficult about it and how we can, you know, protect our minds going forwards. And they actually found that there was a chance, or there was some evidence started to emerge, that actually this could be harmful for people. So talking in massive detail, purely with a focus on the trauma of the event and the difficulty of the event and the horror of the event, isn't necessarily that helpful for people. It can solidify memories that later come back in a worse way. On the flip side to that, debriefing in order to learn and for performance is definitely indicated. So across multiple professions, whether that's military or aviation, meta-analysis shows that if you debrief, your chance of doing better next time improves about 20% or so. So debriefing to learn and debriefing to say what did we do, what went well, what didn't, what can we do better next time? Definite yes. So the big question is, well, if we're debriefing to learn, then how do we address this elephant in the room of, you know, this was really difficult for everyone, and are we going to harm people if we do? And the answer is no, you're not going to cause harm by debriefing people with the primary focus being on learning, but also having a consideration for people's well-being. And if nothing else, it's just good leadership to do that. So I wondered if you've had any debriefs that you've been involved in, Fionn, that you'd be able to describe, and we can kind of see how some of the recommendations that we've got here sort of play into them.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about some of the cases that I've been involved with where we had bad outcomes. And so this was a while back, and thinking of a particular case, a young gentleman who'd taken paracetamol overdose, who had a staggered overdose. We didn't quite know how many or if I heard when. He was very vague, and then presented with epigastric pain, horrible acidosis, horrible LFTs, and later and platelets were sort of like 10 or something like that. Later arrested, but not before he'd vomited up a load of blood and climbed off his recess trolley and was on the floor. So it was traumatic all round because of the nature of the resuscitation. We were all kneeling in a pool of blood on the floor in recess, resuscitating a young man. And there was no formal debrief after the event. It was all sort of like, oh, right, okay, like, let's just go back to shift then and just carry on. which was, now you look back on it, you're like, this is completely ridiculous to expect that we could just wash the blood off and crack on back to Mrs. Doris in the waiting room. but that was what happened. Pretty much the whole team kind of dissipated, and we're like, oh, right, okay, you know, unfortunate outcome. Let's get the family in, and then we'll just carry on with our shift, which left a lot of unanswered questions about how the resuscitation had been handled. Had we done everything we could have? Is there anything we could have done differently that might have changed the outcome? You know, probably not. But those questions were sort of whirling around in my head. And then we had this was a coroner's referral, and this was a serious incident review within the hospital as well. And that meant that I had to write a statement. I had to go through the events in quite a lot of detail, and I had to go through the whole psychological kind of how I felt at every point of that resuscitation and afterwards, which was definitely not helpful. Instead of feeling that I could kind of park it and move on, it meant that I had to keep reliving it and going through it. I mean, that's probably a whole separate topic on like how our processes of review and coroners, etc., are potentially not good for providers or for healthcare physicians. But it does emphasize the point that potentially dissecting cases in detail and going through the trauma, it sounds kind of, I don't know, cliche to say the trauma of it, but it is fairly traumatic. And it's to say, right, to debrief it in such a way that says, okay, so tell me how that made you feel. Why were you upset by that? What was upsetting, and why was that difficult? And it's like, okay, well, let's dig into these really deep, difficult topics again and again and again, which wasn't helpful.
Yes. So I think certainly it's a topic for another time to think about our processes, because I agree, certainly I've luckily never been in that position yet, but I'm sure I will be, where you're constantly having to go through something that actually you just don't want to be faced with. So it's difficult, the divide, when you know you have a legal requirement to go through something again. But I think the first thing to say about debriefing is it's kind of an opt-out. So the premise being that the focus is how can we save someone's life better next time? And for that reason, as clinicians, we should all want to do a debrief for that reason. But we also don't want to force people to be there who are actually like, you know what, the last thing I want to do right now is talk about this case. So the first thing to say is that people can opt out of a debrief. If they don't want to be there, that's fine, but they should always be checked upon later if they don't want to be in it. And then debriefing generally follows a model of gather, analyze, summarize. Most of the literature is sort of like that sort of premise. And for the Research Council resource, we've used the STOP 5 model, which was developed in NHS Lothian by Craig Walker. And it's reasonably prolifically used. And it's very simple more than anything. It's easy to do. And I did one for one of the arrests that I'd led on the weekend on my night shift. And it's basically get everyone together for 5 minutes. You grab the team. You all get face to face with each other, introduce each other, and you say, right, we're going to stop for 5 minutes. We're going to do things that went well, opportunities to improve, and then we're going to plan for the next actions that we need to do. And it's as simple as that. We sort of talked about, like, you know, what did we do well? What can we enforce in our practice and keep doing? What things can we do have we done badly? And it sounds like in that case, that would have been really helpful for you to have had the opportunity, if someone else was leading that, to then say, oh, well, actually, I thought we could have got them on a table or something, and we could have maybe done that, and that would have, like, in future, maybe we would do that, and everyone can say, yeah, actually, that's really good. And then possibly to the point when we go, oh, well, we've used this bit of kit, or we've made this mistake here that actually other people could learn about, and we think we should email and circulate this learning around to the rest of the department. So that's essentially what a debrief is. And the recording of it is something that, again, it's a new bridge to cross. We have to sort of have an opinion on how it should be recorded. And we've suggested that the whole point of a debrief is that people can speak very openly and learn. So that's the priority, is to not create a barrier to that. And we thought, if there's undue and over documentation of that, if you're saying, I felt like I could have done this a lot better, and someone's sitting there writing that down going, all right, well, this will be good in coroner's court when we absolutely nail you for admitting to that thing that you did wrong, that's not going to encourage people to do a good debrief. So it's recording who was there, recording a bare minimum of information about the content of the debrief, with the exception of any sort of critical issues that need to be reported for safety reasons, things that we would do an error report for, those types of things obviously still need to be reported in the usual way. And that's kind of the current best suggestion that we can come up with as to what should be recorded in a debrief. And then it kind of comes on to the elephant in the room is the psychological side of it, and how can we use this as an opportunity to best support the people that we have? And it sounds like in your case, you've kind of alluded to that sort of being a bit lacking, and that idea of, like, sometimes, you know, it's a show of good leadership to acknowledge how difficult the event was, and then, well, there's some things that we recommend can help for people. So one of them is educating people on those reactions. So as you said, sometimes people have no idea what their mind is about to do to them, and they have no education. You know, if you've got someone on in a pre-hospital setting, it can be so helpful to deliver that basic education that we all now kind of are a bit more familiar with, on that process and what's common and what's not, and when to seek help and to signpost to useful guidance. We can also kind of reassure on performance limits. So basically saying, the survival of this person did not depend on what you did then, if that's appropriate to say. And sometimes it might not be. It's sometimes legitimately, and it's the thing that we all fear, is that we're in a situation where we have done an act or an omission that has actually killed someone. And if that's the case, then, you know, you can only be a human in that situation and say what you think is the right thing to say at the time. But still striving to learn from that, because we've kind of put a quote from Henry Ford, who made the Ford cars. He said that, you know, the only mistake is the one that we didn't learn from, and that being the premise that no matter how bad it is, as long as we can learn and we can change from this event, and, you know, either change yourself, change the system, change whatever you can to make sure that the same thing doesn't happen again. And then active monitoring and buddying up. And I think you'd mentioned a really good example of, in your mountain rescue team, how they're really hot on making sure that we they can buddy people and make sure that they can follow each other up and act, start that process of active monitoring, what we call it.
Yeah, I think there's two good examples, I think. I'm aware I've talked a lot about the bad examples, but I've experienced some good examples too. So the HEMS team that I worked for up in North Wales had a system where if there'd been, it'd be flagged up, you know, example, pediatric arrest or a hanging or something that sounded difficult. The top cover consultant would call the team that was involved a couple of days later, maybe the day after, and just say, I saw that case you had looked really difficult. You know, how are you guys doing? You okay? Any issues to flag up, sort of thing. So very kind of informal, but a nice way to just check in on people. And I think as well that HEMS teams, to some extent, have got a big advantage in that they're close-knit teams, small teams, and they often have time to chat, time to talk. So there's often time on the way back from a job. There's time when you're back at base over a cup of tea and a biscuit. So they will informally debrief quite a lot, pretty much every case will be talked about, which is good. But then you've also got that more formal, like top cover consultant calling to check in. Then you've got the mountain rescue format, which is... I think far more important in a way, because a lot of volunteers who are not necessarily medically trained, who see some pretty horrible stuff, and it may be the only time they ever see this horrible stuff, because it's not their day in, day out job. So I think it's even more important to check in on mountain rescuers who are exposed to some pretty traumatic things. So my team's got a system where our leadership team has gone on the MedTrim course, the sort of trauma resilience training, and they will get the team together immediately after incident, as in still on scene, immediately afterwards. Okay, guys, we're not going to talk about it now, but this was a difficult case. We're going to be checking in with you in the next couple of days. So they'll make a note of who was there. They'll make a note of anybody who appears particularly sort of affected or sort of upset by this, and then gets sort of assigned out to people who feel comfortable to talk to people about it. So often that is the paramedics or doctors in the team, and then we sort of call up people and ask how they're doing after a particularly difficult case. And it's not in a way that's like so... chest compressions, that can be really hard because you can feel the ribs break and you can see the person's face getting, you know, start bleeding out their airway and stuff, and like, that must be really difficult, tell me about that. It's not in a way that's trying to provoke trauma. It's in a way to just flag up how you're feeling. Do you want to discuss anything? If not, that's absolutely fine. It's just a kind of like friendly check-in sort of thing. I just wanted to mention here as well, I think it's there's the whole, you know, it's okay not to be okay thing, which is I think a good thing that's come out of COVID, but also don't feel any expectation that you should feel upset by things, because sometimes you won't be upset by things and you may feel guilty and that you might think you're a complete psychopath for not being upset by something. That's not true. That's it, that's fine. You know, there is no right way to react to things, and some people will be, you know, maybe completely traumatized by something that you're completely okay with, and that doesn't make your reaction, you know, any less sort of normal. There is no normal for these things.
That's a fantastic thing to say, and we have no way to predict currently who will react in what way or who will not and why, and there's also no way to pre-screen people, because they did that a lot in the military as well, being basically like, oh, can we weed out the weak ones who are all going to cry after these traumas and stuff. Obviously that's not a weak thing to do at all. Like, I think I'll say I actually cried when I came back from a night shift. It was so terrible, and I don't think that makes me a weak doctor particularly, and
I've cried many times on shift.
It's common as hell, but basically you can't predict who's going to react when and how and why. And the psychopath thing is definitely a thing. I am, after having had this horrific experience in a pediatric arrest pre-hospital about 7 months ago, I got another opportunity to shadow an awesome critical care paramedic on a solo car. We had another pediatric cardiac arrest, and as horrific and sad as it was, I felt a great sense of reward and you know, a sense of satisfaction from being able to do some more interventions and feel like a useful member of the team, whereas previously I've been a rabbit in the headlights in those situations. And I felt overall positive after ultimately a child had died, which is a really weird thing to say. And obviously it was horrendously sad, and it made me very sad to think about it. But I actually felt a sense of satisfaction. I felt a sense that I'd done well in that situation and sort of got something out of it, where I was like, yeah, like this is why I turn up to work. Like I've tried my best here and it's gone well.
I think many of our, I think naturally we feel inclined to look at outcome-based measures of performance, i.e. did they survive or not? However, I think when you're talking about resuscitation, and you said this right at the beginning, you know, the majority, vast majority of our patients are not going to survive resuscitation. And that's almost regardless of what we do. You know, I think we need to move away from measuring our performance based on the outcome of the patient. And we should move towards measuring our performance based on our performance. I think that is so much more healthier in terms of mindset. Yeah, and how well we actually think it went versus did the patient survive or not?
Yeah, exactly. Because a lot of the time, whether someone survives or not might be out of your control as a team, whereas what is in your control is to drill yourself so that your procedures are as good as they can be for that one person, where it will literally make the difference, that absolute fine line between life and death. Yeah, that's a really good point.
I've given you a couple of examples of like the active monitoring that I've experienced subsequently from like the HEMS team and the mountain rescue team. So what's the kind of next step after that then?
So hopefully, if there's any negative symptoms, they'll all kind of fizzle out and disappear. Referral, as we say, if there's anything ongoing. And then after that, I suppose sort of what we're doing is like periodic team reflection. So like there's a thing called Schwartz rounds where people can kind of speak about cases which have impacted them. And essentially that's helpful because it can act towards, again, helping us know how common these things are and also share kind of advice and tips with each other as to how we've managed to get our head around difficult things. And it's just exactly what you've just done there, saying, you know, actually, you know, if it is upsetting when the outcome is bad for the patient, but actually like sometimes we can take positives away from the process we've got there and all of that sort of stuff, where we can share our own real practical experience, which I guess is the gold dust of how we can actually sort of get through all of these really difficult experiences that we're putting ourselves through. And then the next section, I suppose, if we wanted to move on from there, is trying to give perspective on the debrief. So I suppose, bluntly put, it's probably a drop in the ocean when it comes to the well-being of a responder. And in that sense, I suppose, don't get too upset or don't feel too much pressure to be able to fix anything in a debrief, because that's not really the purpose of a debrief, and it's probably unlikely to help. All you can really do is capture people in a safety net and just do the human thing to try and offer some supportive words. And actually, there's all of these other things that have a huge impact. So the organization, I think without going into it too much, there's primary stressors, which are the things that we ideally want to target. So that's like your shift patterns, your exposure to resuscitation, like your level of autonomy, support in the workplace, all of that sort of stuff. The things that kind of stress us out on a day-to-day basis, like, you know, have you got tea-making facilities? All of these things are your kind of primary stressors, and that's in the context of your psychosocial home environment, all of that stuff all combined. And that they're the things to for the organization, the caring and good leading organization, to target and say, actually, can we make your life easier at work by helping get rid of some of this stress that the systems are putting on you? And then if that has been maxed out and you've done everything you can do, so for example, in the context of resuscitation, there's only a limit to how much you can avoid being exposed to that stressor. Night shifts, there's only a limit to how much you can stop people doing night shifts when you want a 24-hour service. Then you move on to your secondary things, which is the stressor is there. How do we cope with and improve our ability to cope with that stressor? So that's your kind of resilience training, your trim training, debriefing, all that sort of stuff, which it allows people the opportunity to appraise how they are responding to stress and if they can do anything differently. And then, of course, you've got your tertiary support, which is, you know, if people are really needing help and they need a professional who is experienced at helping people through difficulties with their mental health, that's the point when they go in. And of course, every organization is going to need to have that sort of contingency and have that, because there will be a lot of us who need that support at one point or another in our lives. So that needs to be there too. And then think about what we can do as leaders. The number one thing is, even though it sounds a bit trite, is just being a good leader. So the most reassuring thing for followers to protect their mental health is that their leader is doing a good job at what they're meant to be doing. So there's no use in kind of being terrible and dangerous and haphazard at your day job, but being brilliant at bringing everyone cups of tea and donuts and stuff to help their mental health. Everyone's going to get quite stressed out at the fact that, like, you're not focusing 100% on your main job. So actually that's the best thing to put energy into. If in doubt, just do your main job and do your primary role as a leader really well, and that's probably the best thing you can do. And then colleagues, look, talk to each other about it, check up on each other, be a person to listen to you know, when you're finding your colleagues in difficulty. And you mentioned about teams and the importance of kind of getting to know each other sort of on and off the pitch. So I think you were saying before about you know, it's the advantage of having a really close-knit team is just the tone of voice in which someone says hello to you in the morning, you'll be like, "Ooh, what's wrong?" Whereas if you don't know each other, then you've got no idea if someone's really struggling, and they might be passed off as just being a bit grumpy or a bit rude. And actually that you know, it's by really getting to know each other properly, that's often the best thing. And we often feel it the most when we're in new environments, new job, don't know anyone. You've not got that real ally and that friendship and camaraderie there, which is really, really important to build and develop. And then individual things. So this is, oh yeah, go for it. Yeah.
I was just going to add along the colleagues and sort of team type thing. Especially, I noticed this in A&E, and I think this is probably true of other places, workplaces as well. But when you start your shift, you walk in, "Hey, hello, how are you? You okay?" And we don't really listen to the response. Yeah. You ever noticed that?
There's no break, exactly, and
we don't really ever get the opportunity to sit down and say, "How are you fine?" But I've started to make a bit more of an effort with this, and I think I've noticed other people doing it more as well, is that when you say, like, "How are you?" wait for a response, and obviously listen and reflect, and most people will say sort of, "Oh yeah, I'm good, I'm fine, whatever," but some people, and I do this as well, something, you know, I'm okay, I'm just okay, you know, it's okay to not be just that automatic response of, "I'm good, yeah, fine, yeah, just, you know, busy, etc." And or you can just say, "You know, yeah, I'm not really feeling it today, but I'm all right." You know, it's fine to just not have that automatic "I'm good" response, and it tells your colleagues so much more about you than just your stock response.
Yeah, that's a good shout. So actually saying maybe we should be a bit more in our own as well as being good at asking that question and waiting for other people and actually listening to what they've got to say, actually in your own response, not just being like, "Yep, all good, totally fine," despite all the horrific things that happened in the last, like, shift and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And I find that you get a sense that we're kind of losing that, I guess, what used to be in the old, like, firm structures in hospitals and that, like, canteen culture, and especially when you've got shift workers, it's so difficult to have that continuity. And so it's things like designing rotas so that you can, like, fix teams together who pass through a rota system, so that you actually all can leave and, you know, all plan to get breakfast together at the same time, and creating, like, training sessions which are, like, paid for and put into the timetable so that people can actually go face to face at the same time all every week, so that they actually get the opportunity to have that sort of like off pitch bonding, which is so important, isn't it? And often, like, yeah, as you say, in A&E especially, you don't often get that.
Especially in A&E, you walk in, it's a 14-hour wait, there's like hundreds of patients in your department and they're all dying and they're all sick, and you're just like, right, I've just got to get in there and just start treating patients and seeing them. And I'm sure it's the same for, you know, our paramedic colleagues who come on shift and there's, you know, a stack of calls waiting to be answered, etc. But I've started making more of an effort to sit down and chat, which sounds ridiculous. But you sit down, you're like, hey, how was your weekend? What did you get up to? Oh, your son was playing football, you know. Oh, 5-0, they got absolutely smashed. You know, just having a little chat with your colleagues. And, you know, I found out one of my colleagues is an ex-jockey and he used to race horses for a living. But just knowing those little personal details and make it literally takes you 2 minutes. You can time it 2 minutes to, and especially with your junior colleagues and your nursing colleagues, etc., you'll have such a better working dynamic with them. And when it comes to those tough situations like a resuscitation and a debrief, etc., if you know your team that little bit better because you took 2 minutes at the start of your shift to actually have some small talk, it's I think something that's really a powerful thing to do and pretty easy to achieve.
Yeah, that's absolute gold, because it's that stuff, isn't it? If you're chatting, you can say, well, actually, sorry, I'm just dramatically enhancing well-being in the department, and actually this is a real priority for our modern day workforce that needs to be resilient in times of terror and toughness. Massively. That's really, 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 really good to hear. And so, individual things, what do you do for to look after your well-being? The question that I'm very interested in here.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this is all learnt from hard experience. I burnt out in COVID, much like many people. And when you're talking about stresses and primary, secondary stresses, it's all just bringing up so many things that were going on for me at the moment, at the time even. So I had a new job. I had a puppy. I had a house that I was renovating. I had a court case that I had to go to court with a builder about. My parents were abroad, my partner was working away, and it was COVID lockdown and you couldn't leave the house. So that was what was going on in my life at the time. And it was all pretty stressful from like an individual personal stresses that were going on. And many of my usual coping mechanisms, which, you know, unsurprisingly, given we're on the World Extreme Medicine podcast, were outdoors, were not available because of lockdown. So I was a very unhappy bunny. And then I had a couple of difficult cases at work, some of which I've already talked about. There's a couple happened around about that time. And I'd started working a full-time A&E rota for the first time in my life, which was terrible. And night shifts were mega hard. And nobody had told me sort of some top tips and things to do and not do, etc. And I was sort of all just figuring it out by myself. And coming home to an empty house with nobody to talk to. So you can already, when you start putting it like that, you're like, well, obviously you were stressed out and obviously you burnt out. But at the time, I was completely, had no insight into what was going on and thought that I should just be able to magically cope with all of this. And so felt extra shame that I wasn't able to cope with it. So I actually ended up in A&E personally with a headache that wouldn't go away after a set of night shifts. I had I had 4 nights in a row. I was teaching medical students as well, which I love teaching, but it does add extra cognitive load to an already sort of like busy night shift. And I went home and I had like this headache that wasn't going away with paracetamol, with ibuprofen. I had a bit of neck stiffness and I called my consultant and I was like, what do you think? Like, do I need to get this checked out? And he's like, yeah, mate, you've got neck stiffness. Like, you need to go to A&E. So I ended up in A&E getting a CT head and I had a blood pressure of 160 over 90 as a 24-year-old. So that was not ideal. So yeah, probably a bit of a combination of blood pressure and tension and fatigue and lack of sleep had culminated in a physical presentation of stress. So from then on, I had to start taking
No, that was the only thing that you stop when eventually your actual body like physically broke down so that you couldn't even continue.
Yeah, and unfortunately that's the same for a lot of people, you know. You get ill and that's what forces you to stop rather than actually, you know, recognizing the warning signs, which I think I'm getting better at now. I certainly haven't ended up getting another CT head, so that's good. I then had to start taking some of the coping mechanisms seriously. So that was things like drinking enough water, not trying to have a social life whilst on night shifts, making sure to get some exercise in, whatever it was, if it was walking outside, if it was doing a bit of yoga, and maintaining a bit of a routine, not eating like crap, because that's so easy to do on nights. You just pile in the crisps and the chocolate, and then you get fat and then you feel worse. So I actually said, right, let's try and swap some of that out for some fruit and some water, etc. Make the sensible choices. Let's call friends every now and then. Let's speak to family. Let's get them in the loop and sort of keep the social network there so that it's there if you need it. And I spoke to my consultant about my rotor to see if there was anything we could do about it to make it a little bit more friendly. And I spoke to some of my colleagues about night shifts and how they manage and if they have any tips or anything like that. And I started prioritizing my sleep above everything else. Stopped trying to do so much all the time and started being a little bit kinder to myself and not having such big expectations of myself.
That's awesome. I don't think I need to say anything else. That's such a good summary. Of how to look after yourself. I think people will learn more from that than anything.
Essentially, it's what I always say to my sister, who actually is always she's a civil servant. So anybody who works in the UK knows that, you know, her job is not easy at the moment. But she's I'm always saying to her, like, be more selfish. Which sounds ridiculous, but it's my little tagline for looking after yourself and putting yourself first, not other people, not the department, not your colleagues, not your friends or family. Sometimes you got to cancel that dinner because you just can't face leaving the house and you haven't got the energy. So I'd be really bad at like making plans and then being like, oh, well, I can't let my friends down, so I'm going to have to follow through on this, even though I'm so tired. I can't, you know, I'm just going to have to get on with it and do it. And I would do that, but I would do that for various different things over a period of months. And then it builds up to a point where you can't cope with it anymore. So, but you need to be okay with saying, actually, no, really sorry, mate, I'm not going to be able to make tonight because I haven't got the energy. So putting yourself first and prioritizing yourself, that means your sleep, that means your time. And it's really hard in A&E where we do the job to help others, and so we are used to putting other people before us. It means in A&E, it means going for a wee, it means actually drinking water on shift, and it means actually going home on time and being really strict about it and saying, no, I cannot just look at that ACG. I finished half an hour ago. being more selfish with your time and your resources.
I had quite a chilling comment from a patient who we'd seen, and they'd had weight loss and basically it looked like they had developed a cancer like in their 50s, a relatively quite frighteningly young age. And they also maybe had an infection, so they needed some antibiotics. And I was on, it was say a 13-hour shift, and it was my second shift leading the A&E department. And I tried to be good and let everyone else go for breaks, but I hadn't done that myself. And I was like, oh, how on earth do you take a break here when if you, basically all of medicine is deciding if you eat your sandwich, is someone going to die? And in my head, I was like, when I take this break, this person's not going to get their antibiotics for another like half an hour, and that could really make a difference. So I went to this patient. I told them, I was like, oh, like, you know, I'm really sorry, like it's a 5-hour wait, but I've not taken my break yet because I really want to see you. And they were like, what are you doing not taking your break? If you keep doing that, you're going to end up like me. And they're totally right, because you'll end up with, you know, early cancer from the, which is proven now that stress essentially causes cancer and all that stuff. And I was like, wow, that's a great dressing down by a patient saying, you know, like, don't do this to yourself, because it's actually like, you know, when you're 50, what are you going to regret when you've, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a family and you've got people you love and you want to keep living, and your life ends up being cut short because you've basically wrecked your body doing all of this stuff.
Yeah, and absolutely, it seems like little things every day, you know, I'll just stay a bit longer, I'll just work a bit harder, I'll just sleep a bit less, I'll just do a bit more in my spare time, I'll take my break a bit later, or maybe I'll only have 20 minutes instead of 30, but that adds up over a career to become completely unsustainable.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I think there's hopefully this resource as well will kind of allow that to become a bit clearer for employers and that expectation on what we can put our healthcare staff through when we say, actually, you know, there is an element that this is a genuine occupational hazard that we should take as seriously as exposure to handling radiation every day if you work in a nuclear power plant and all those sorts of things. Like, you know, this is a health risk and actually,
could you imagine, you know, if we had little stress counters instead of radiation counters, we'd have little stress counters. That would be great. I would love that. It would be like, no, my stress count is 99 out of 100. I need to take my break. Goodbye. But yes, this resource hopefully will be very powerful to show employers that this is how you support your workforce and how you keep them in work rather than them having to leave through burnout or ill health, etc.
Exactly, and I think that's the ultimate thing. You want to, if you're an employee, you want to pay employees who are going to enjoy their job, not burn out, and actually turn up when you're paying them to turn up. And that's not going to happen if you're running people into the ground, and we end up in the situation that we're seeing now, where there's a lot of holes, and there's not that many people that can fill all of those holes now anymore because it's too much. I'm hopeful that this, hopefully with your help, Fiona, this the World Extreme Medicine podcast, if it spreads far and wide and people can see it and they can use this to make tangible change in their organisations, into their personal life and with the teams that they're working in, to hopefully care for ourselves, and then we can provide gold standard care to our patients.
Oh, fantastic, Matt. And I would highly recommend having a read of the resource, and Matt's going to tell us where we can find it in a minute. And also the video is absolutely excellent that Matt's made with the HEMS team that he was attached to. It's a really good resource. So even if you've only got 5 minutes, or when you're next taking your break, when you should do on your shift, have a look at it, and it will change the way you think about well-being and debrief, I guarantee. And where can we find it, Matt?
So we can find this at resus.org.uk/responder-wellbeing, or you can just Google Resus Council Responder Wellbeing Resource and you should be able to find a link there.
Fantastic. Well, I think that's a great place to finish. And thank you so much for your time. Thank you for creating this fantastic resource. And I hope that, as you say, it starts to influence the well-being of our responders, and hopefully keep us happy and healthy and in work until we're 100.
Thanks so much for having me, Fiona. It's been great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical and performance medicine. Thanks again.